Congratulations, commissioners of coffee consumption. Being a localized terrorist takes a lot of work. I don't get a lot of sleep, so I drink a lot of Java juice to avoid getting all fuzzy. And settling for a lesser brand will make you lose your mind! So I implore you citizens of Gotham to start buying Sparkplug coffee. They start with premium Arabica beans, and they're the freshest and of the best quality. You probably don't have money to burn like I do, but this direct and fairly traded product is the only way to go. It's about what's fairly traded. That's right, Harvey. Decaf, half-calf, whatever you want, they got it, and they'll ship it to you within a week. Maybe on boats that aren't wired to explode. If you think I'm joking, I'm not. I'm not. When you're good at drinking something, never do it without getting a 10% discount, which you can do by visiting sparkplugcoffee.com and using the promo code TOP100PROJECT. One word, number 100. What would I do without my spark plug? It completes me. So plug yourself in and keep yourself crazy sharp at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hello, beautiful. And seriously, thank you for tuning in the Next 113 Project. We used to review the AFI's Top 100 Movies, but won that fight years ago. Now we review incredible movies like this one, and we won't live in fear about spoiling them. I'm the crazed criminal who wants to watch the world burn, Ryan Ellis, and here's the hero the podcast world deserves, and also does need right now, my wife Bev.
That's me.
If I do too much of the Batman voice, my throat is going to go.
It's the impression that our listeners deserve.
Whether they want it or not, right now. Okay, so some warnings off the top. The dogs are with us as always, but more importantly, it's raining, and you might hear that constantly in the background. We do rain, though, so I guess I can't complain too much.
They're calling for thunder and lightning, too, so we might be interrupted by a little bit of that. Feels appropriate, actually, with this movie. A little pathetic fallacy.
So the coming attractions trivia for this week's picture, The Dark Knight. The Joker character has been in, I count, 4 live-action big-screen movies. How many times has the character died?
So I've only seen 2 of the 4. I think it's just in the 1989 Batman that he dies at the end.
That is correct. He survives in Suicide Squad. He survives in this movie. We don't know what his fate is. He's probably going to Arkham Asylum. And he does survive in the 1966 Batman, where Cesar Romero plays him.
I didn't even look up the 1966 Batman. I just remember that being so corny and decaffeinated that I never imagined they would kill anybody in that movie.
I think all the villains are in that film, too. I saw it, don't remember much about it. The most famous thing might be the shark repellent spray that's on Batman's utility belt. And it does come in handy. But this film is not quite as silly as that one. Sometimes maybe it is, but in general it's not. And The Dark Knight was released just a few days shy of 10 years ago by Warner Brothers on July 18th, 2008. And it made all the money. I don't know why people would need an explanation, Bev, but give them the skinny on The Dark Knight.
Christian Bale is orphan billionaire Bruce Wayne by day, masked vigilante Batman by night, who protects Gotham City but is getting pretty tired of it if you ask him. And just when it looks like Aaron Eckhart's Attorney General Harvey Dent is ready to clean up the city for reals this time and leave Bruce lots of free time to steal Harvey's girlfriend, Heath Ledger's Joker emerges, hell-bent on beginning a violent reign of chaos and revealing Batman's true identity to the world.
The Batman. Or in a nutshell, lawyer and thief with noticeably scarred faces battle brooding billionaire who would be easily identified if someone would just scar the bottom half of his face. Someone should just take a knife out, scratch that chin with it, and you'd always know who he is in reality, unless he just doesn't ever come out. Which, of course, in The Dark Knight Rises, the storyline is Bruce Wayne's been in hiding for about 8 years. So no one would see him anyway, but my point remains.
He misses the Batman. He needs the Batman.
What would I do without you? So the Rotten Tomatoes numbers on this and the other films, for that matter, Dark Knight Rises and the one before, Batman Begins. Dark Knight, 94% of critics, 307 fresh, but 20 rotten, and 94% of audiences also. And it's 4th on the IMDb's 250. It has been in that spot for a very long time. The Dark Knight Rises Rotten Tomatoes numbers, 87% and 90%. A little bit surprising, that movie was divisive. And Batman Begins is 84% and 94%. As far as the money goes for all the movies, Dark Knight is 32nd on Box Office Mojo's top 300 adjusted for inflation, and was also number one in 2008. We said that last week on Iron Man, which was number two. And Dark Knight Rises is 70th on the Box Office Mojo 300. Batman Begins is 278th.
If you're ever wondering how much credit Heath Ledger deserves for the success of this film, both critically and financially, I think you can just easily compare it to Batman Begins and Dark Knight Rises.
Well, Batman Begins succeeded, but The Dark Knight beat Batman Begins' entire box office haul in a matter of days. And I remember when the movie was coming out that I was surprised at how much people wanted to see this movie. I went to go see this, I think it was not long after it came out, at about noon on a Tuesday, and it would have been late July. Sold out. I was there about an hour in advance, didn't matter. I went to see Step Brothers instead and had a good time. It might have been a month later before I finally saw this movie, and even then, it was a packed house and also at about noon. But it was the IMAX screen. Maybe that's part of the reason why.
Oh, yeah, that's a good reason why.
All right, well, anyway, your thoughts on The Dark Knight, our second consecutive superhero movie.
I'm a bit of a contrarian on The Dark Knight, just in the way that I don't think it's anywhere near the perfect film that a lot of fans think it is. I find the story way too busy. I find Christian Bale's Batman way too emo.
What do you mean?
But seriously, who cares? It's the most beautiful superhero film by a country mile, and Heath Ledger as the Joker bestowed us with this gift of a performance. Honestly, the performance of a generation. It's impossible to be hyperbolic about it.
When people were talking about how great it was going to be in, I think, January of that year, right around the time he died, I thought, that does look really good. But people, I guess, in the industry wouldn't stop talking about how great he was going to be. And I thought, there's no way. You finally see the movie, and I think they underrated how great he is.
Before this, what had he done that would have ever prepared you to expect this surprising performance? He does some good performances that were realistic performances, but to do something as gutsy as the Joker, the way that he does it. And it was easy to assume when all the hype was coming up, of course you're saying that. He died tragically, so young. Stupid, accidental overdose of prescription medicine. The most tragic thing you can imagine. So then, in one of his last performances, people are saying how great it was. Sure it was. You know, we're all sad he's gone. But then we all saw the movie, and still, 10 years later, people will cite it as one of the greatest performances
in cinema history. He's constantly surprising you with the things he does, the choices he makes. People misinterpret what choices means. Okay, it can be choosing your film roles, but it means choices in the character. I'm sure that Ledger and Christopher Nolan talked about everything that he does before and during the filming, because Nolan, of course, is the director and the writer and everything, producer on this movie. But whoever came up with between the two of them, or just Ledger himself, the way he talks, the laugh he came up with, the posture he puts forward, the I'm not that I tried to do in the sponsor promo. I've seen the movie so many times, and every time I watch it, I see something different he did. My favorite gesture, maybe in the history of movies, I've talked about lines that have multiple meanings. And this is a line too, but it's more about the gesture. When he first sees Rachel Dawes, he's got the knife in his hand. He's brushing his stringy hair back. Hello, beautiful. I want to make myself look better for you because you're pretty.
Which is absurd because he's got the hair and makeup.
Right. But it's also, I've got a knife in my hand, gesturing the knife. Look what I'm going to do to you.
It's cartoonish. He is a clown and he makes jokes. He has a sense of humor and he's funny. That anybody could be this funny and this scary at the same time is another achievement. And this is a man who, I mean, what was he best known for before this? Brokeback Mountain, the most subdued, controlled performance.
Mostly, yeah. There's a few outbursts, but mostly he is completely controlled.
It's hard to believe that that is the same person embodying these two characters. I read that Nolan approached Heath Ledger to play Batman in Batman Begins. I don't know if this is verified.
He'd be so young to have played that character, although Bale, I guess, isn't exactly an old man himself.
And how old is Bruce Wayne supposed to be when he takes up the Batman? He's maybe an orphan, he's angry this whole time. They could age him up. I guess he could pull it off, but thank God he didn't get cast. While I may disagree, I think most people do think that Christian Bale is the best Batman.
Of all the Batmans ever?
This is what people say. When I was doing my research, I saw that come up over and over again. I'm a Michael Keaton fan myself.
I like Keaton too. Maybe Bale's better overall, but it's close.
I think I just like Michael Keaton better because I was 11 when that movie came out. So to me, he's always going to be my Batman. I have a soft spot for it. And I'm just not a fan of Christian Bale in general either. I'm not a fan of Batman as a character. I just find him really whiny and joyless.
Get over it. It was decades ago. Well, don't get over it, maybe, but he could do more good and affect more change with his money than with his muscles in Gotham. And at the end of the third movie, that is what's going to happen, although he's supposed to be dead. And whether or not he's dead, his legacy is all that's left, officially. And then Wayne Manor is going to become this place for troubled and at-risk kids. So finally he's doing that. And maybe he had been before.
He could change the world. But instead, he just nurses his rage, puts on a costume, and beats people up.
Getting revenge for my parents!
It's such a waste of resources, it's a waste of his time, and a waste of his empathy, too, or anger, whatever. You could do so much good, but instead you choose to just have this elaborate ruse as an excuse to beat people up. I can't believe how popular he is as a character, as a superhero. But he is. I mean, Batman is probably number one.
We said last week on Iron Man that Iron Man and Batman are probably number one and 1A, or number one and number two as far as currently, popular superhero comic book characters.
And they share so many similarities. We talked about this in Iron Man, of course, that they're both orphans, they're both born rich, they're both very smart, they have these gadgets, and they both have no real superpowers.
Very ordinary people.
Yeah, and they both ultimately end up on these teams of superheroes as well. They have very different motivations and missions, but they just share so much in common.
So this movie has an irresponsible rating of PG-13. It should have been an R. There's barely any blood, and that's what it comes down to. I always point to the Lord of the Rings films, which I do love, but characters, people, orcs, whatever, get their heads cut off. How is that not an R? But because there's no blood, or it's black blood in their case. The pencil trick, as great as it is, We both laugh, but there's no blood. So somehow that and many other things in this film...
So disturbing.
...did only a PG-13. There's no way young people should be watching this film.
It's almost worse that you don't see the man's face after the pencil trick. And then other really gruesome stuff, like I think of the cell phone thing where they're in prison and he's sewn the bomb into the Batman with the cell phone in there and then he explodes. It's so visceral. I had never thought about that. I don't think I realized it was a PG-13 rating. That is absolutely
some of it's just suggestions too when he breaks the pool cue in half and says, we only have room for one on the team, so we're going to have tryouts. And you have to just envision what he's about to do. What he also does to Gamble, the mobster, puts the knife in his mouth. And his first, well, I don't know if it's a lie, but he does tell two different versions. And he's about to tell a third to Batman until Batman defeats him at the very end.
One of my favorite details.
His origin, one of his origin story, First it's about his father who cuts his face. Why, he's so serious. And then it's about how his wife had that happen to her. And he does the same thing, but then she doesn't love him anymore. He tells that to Rachel.
Such a great detail, because so many films would humanize their villain, but I think the best thing about the Joker, in The Dark Knight specifically, is how refreshing it is that he just gets to be evil. There's no redemption. There's no heartbreaking, rationalizing backstory. He's just bad.
He just wants to watch the world burn.
And he's not sorry.
Well, he gets all that money and just burns it.
Oh, what an incredible scene.
One of the trivia bits is that Lau is on top of the money.
Yeah.
And he's being burned too, but there's no noise. And again, that's probably the ratings board. Maybe they did originally have sound in there and they thought, oh, if we leave that in, that's horrific and that's going to get us an R.
Can you imagine how traumatizing that scene is for rich people or mobsters. Capitalist Republicans? No, that money, it was so innocent. It never had a chance.
Well, we mentioned Lau, and Dent wants Batman to kidnap him. He's the DA who advocates criminal action. But then Harvey envies both the vigilantes and the criminals in this story, at least. He kind of wants to be both all along, I think. Now, he's got a reason to be Two-Face at the end of the film. But I think he envies these people. That's one thing, too, about the makeup and everything, the burned face. Great makeup. Well, it's actually both a combination of makeup and maybe more visual effects. Nolan's known to do an awful lot of real effects, including the truck flipping over.
Practical effects. And you can tell.
Can't be because things have been burned off of his face. Some of the great makeup, including Arnold in Terminator 2, is additions. So if you look at it, as great as the makeup is on Arnold when he starts to get beat up and shot at and everything towards the end of the film, he has too much face, if you will.
Yeah.
But Dent has less, and that's because it's visual
effects. 10 years later, it still looks phenomenal.
Now, we also said, how can he speak? How can his eye work at all? And all that kind of thing. First of all, you have to cut that slack because the comic book character is what they're portraying. Also, he has gas that gets in his mouth and on the right side of his face. None of that burns. But okay, fine. He's being Two-Face. I also think that the movie may be portraying that he's not going to live long. So if he's got infections, if he's got problems, if he's going to die from any of that within hours or days, I don't think he cares. He's going out there to try to get revenge, and he doesn't live more than a matter of hours after he leaves the hospital anyway.
I will say that I find Harvey Dent's arc to be one of the mild failures of the film.
Failure?
Yeah, I love him in like the first two acts of the film before he gets burned up. I think his performance is phenomenal. I love Aaron Eckhart. I can't believe he isn't an A-list star. He was so close around this time. He had a few hits and then, I don't know, it just seemed like he got relegated to B-lister. But still a great actor. He has a great resume. I love him in this movie until the point where he turns. They did such a good job of making him this Boy Scout hero in the first two parts of the film. I buy it that he wants adventure. As you say, there's a great scene in the courtroom where he fights the guy right there on the stage.
Snatches a gun away from him.
So cool about it. He has this little superhero quip at the end of it. And he is willing to make himself the bait to be kidnapped, as you say. But he's not evil. He may be gutsy. He may be adventurous. But the idea that losing Rachel, this is one of my complaints about Nolan in general, that I think there's just too much story. There's too many plot beats and not enough emotional beats. Rachel dies, and the audience really needs a moment to absorb how impactful that is, but we don't get it.
We get
a one shot of Batman looking remorseful in a pile of rubble.
I think that's what they're going for. I think they think that's enough.
It doesn't work for me. Does it work for you? Harvey's so heartbroken that he turns evil in that moment.
He was already mad at Gordon before, and he talks about his corrupt unit, and then it's proven that he's right. When he's still normal, even, gets madder at Gordon about his corrupt unit, and he's not wrong. So I buy his anger at him, and so the cops in general, then. He's not a cop, of course. He's a lawyer. Batman, maybe he's got issues with him to begin with, because he is operating outside the law, but he does take advantage of that. But then he feels like Batman didn't save Rachel and Batman let the Joker do the things he did, so fuck you too to that guy. Aaron Eckhart, if he'd been the only villain in this film, might be the one who won the Oscar. He's great in the whole movie, I think, but he's overshadowed by an even better villain, and maybe there are too many villains. Spider-Man 3 had that problem the year before this. I don't think this movie suffers from it the way that one did, but I do buy the arc.
He turns on a child. I would buy it if he just turned on the people that he saw as being to blame.
That's what he thinks he's doing. And but Batman calls him on that in that pretty emotional standoff between the three of them, with, of course, Gordon's family being part of it, too. But it's really between Gordon, Dent, and Batman.
This gives me a chance to bring up my other problem with this film, which is crisis fatigue. The last half hour of the film has too many crises happening at once. You got the fake clown hostages, the fairy dilemma, Harvey Dent taking Commissioner Gordon's family hostage. Perhaps the story is meant to start wearing out the viewer to make the world feel more chaotic and nihilistic. But for me, it just, in the end, reduces my investment in each event.
Of all those, I would lose the fairy dilemma.
Totally.
Because I don't even really buy the way it goes down, that this great big criminal, Tiny Lister, is playing him. I'll do what you should have done a half hour ago. And throw that thing out the window.
I like the moment, but it takes us forever to get there. I already have all these other things to pay attention to. Save it for another movie. Or eliminate some other crisis to make room for that crisis. And it was just also yet another thing that made it harder and harder to believe that the Joker could actually be pulling this off. This is a borderline
madman. I just do things. He's the most organized and planning-centric villain maybe ever. He's brilliant, and his plans are more elaborate than an elaborate plan. The one where they try to get him into jail, which is where he wants to be in the first place.
And he says, I'm not a schemer. Their plans are impossibly complex. Getting arrested on purpose, which if you think about the scene that leads into that, and all of the truck blowing up, how he could have imagined that he would be taken alive, and that was his whole plan.
How It Should Have Ended is a great, if you've ever looked at them on YouTube, How It Should Have Ended, they have so many followers now. They may be one of more popular movie-type sites, or pop culture sites
for
on
good
YouTube.
Reason.
Yeah, they're really great. But I love the one they show where it's the conflict with the bat pod coming at Joker. Hit me! Hit me! And he does, but he doesn't actually kill him. He just cripples him. You want to know how I got these scars? From Batman? From Batman. Because Batman doesn't want to kill him, but he could have wiped him out and really hurt him badly.
Considering the circumstance, who on earth would fault killing the Joker in that moment? He has caused total havoc.
It's my one rule,
half a dozen cars.
I'll break it sometimes, though.
Oh, my God. But who can fault it? Who cares? I can complain about the nitpicky things about this movie, but the moment when he's standing in the streets, come at me! So worth it. These moments are so powerful.
Also plays off what happens almost at the end of the 1989 Batman, where Nicholson's staying there. Come on, you gruesome son of a bitch.
That's so
and
true.
Batman's shooting at him and somehow missing him. Maybe he's supposed to miss him, I don't know, because it's Batman. He's not supposed to kill anyone.
He's trying to scare him, I guess. But I know exactly what you're talking about. I remember that so well.
And in both cases, Joker does not get hit and eventually gets away. Although he doesn't win in the end. Although you could argue that in this movie, the Joker does win. The Joker cannot win. But I think maybe he does, because it's a rough ending. Good people are dead. Harvey had been a good person until hours before, I guess, or maybe days before. Batman's now a hunted villain. He's taken this on himself. The Joker may have won. Now, on the other hand, one of the worst lines in this movie is definitely about the fairy thing where the bombs don't go off. And the Joker has that look on his face like, wait a second, that didn't work. The only time he seems unsure of himself. And the line that I don't like so much, because Batman Begins had a lot of bad dialogue. I love the movie, but it's got some terrible dialogue. This movie has a lot less. It has some, though. And this line, there's a bunch of people ready to believe in good. It sounded dumb, especially in that deep mechanical voice he has.
There's this Christopher Nolanism. I mean, he has so many Nolanisms. But one of them is that he loves to make the plot so dense you feel like you need a dissertation to follow what's going on. But then when it comes to themes, he beats you over the head with it, with obvious dialogue that they repeat over and over again. And this movie is no exception.
Interstellar, Inception, Memento are all way more complicated than this is by design.
Yeah.
But you're right. This one leans the same way. And I guess when it's the same guy behind the camera, why wouldn't it lean the same way?
Yeah, and he makes these incredible blockbusters that are also intellectually interesting. Visually, I think the best thing that he does is he just has such an incredible eye for shots. We have thunder happening here, if you're wondering what that noise is. I think he tried a little too hard to be intellectual and only sticks the landing like 50% of the time, but when he does, it's just so worth it. And all of his films are united by this theme of mistrust of the world as it's presented to you, and there's always something deceptive about it, and there's always someone behind the curtain pulling the strings to manipulate you. Often his protagonists are the manipulators, and that is definitely true of Batman. He's manipulating the same way that Cobb manipulates in Inception, or sometimes they manipulate themselves like they do in Memento or Cooper and Interstellar. Either way, they drive themselves a little mad.
Who's Cooper and Interstellar again? Is that McConaughey?
Yeah,
That's his name? Okay. I haven't seen that movie a second time.
I had to look it up. The only name I remember in that movie is Murph!
We all know that
Murph!
One.
Murph!
When you say it 75 times in one movie, it's hard to forget.
Oh, that is a movie that is so guilty of beating you over the head with its themes. Mm-hmm. But who cares? Look at it. It's so beautiful.
I wish you'd stop saying who cares, because that's the point of a podcast like this, to analyze these things.
Usually I nitpick films, and I know I'm a harsh critic, but there's something about Nolan's films where, while they can drive me crazy with things that kind of seem like not as smart as they wish they were, or beating you over the head with themes. Also, I find he's visually very muddy with his action scenes. He doesn't direct action all that well, or he tries to cheat things too much, and it makes his action scenes sometimes really visually incomprehensible. But he is one of the few directors that can just erase all of his shortcomings with
Moments.
Magic. Unbelievable things that no other filmmaker can do.
So is he a modern master? They always called Hitchcock the master. That's not what Nolan does. It's a different genre. That was mostly thrillers. And Nolan's taking on all kinds of films. But is he a modern master?
I think a lot of people would say yes. I would say no. I am not on
Team Nolan.
Fanboys would definitely say yes. I respect him as a filmmaker way more than I respect Michael Bay, who also makes huge Hollywood blockbusters. Yeah, that's probably a bad comparison, but I would sooner watch a Christopher Nolan film than a Steven Spielberg film, I think.
Well, Nolan's usually got original stories. This isn't original, but generally he's had original stories with big budgets, and that's not common anymore. Even though his biggest movie ever is a superhero film, and so many movies, when you look at the Box Office Mojo Top 300 adjusted for inflation I talked about, are comic book movies, or even films of this type, the big budget action films. But anyway, forget about that. We'll just say comic book movies specifically. We mentioned on Iron Man where Avengers and Black Panther and Infinity War all stack up. They're all in the top 35, last I looked, and Black Panther and the first Avengers, I believe, are 29-30. That will probably change by the time this podcast goes up, but the point is they were huge hits too. So he's a hit maker, and he uses practical visual effects. He's his own writer. He's become his own producer. He wrote this with his brother Jonathan, who now works on Westworld, and David Goyer has a story credit. There was something on the IMDb about how Goyer says, "I can't believe my name's attached to a movie this good." He also produced with his wife, Emma Thomas, who always produces his films, and Charles Roven, who's produced a lot of films. That's the behind-the-scenes people, but this is Nolan's film. He's an auteur, whether you like him or not. And as I said, fanboys obviously do. He's become their guy, like Spielberg was in his day. And Nolan hasn't made a failure yet. Memento wasn't a big success, but it was also an art house film. It probably succeeded for the budget. I don't know how much it cost, but I'm sure it made money, considering it was a low-budget movie with no stars.
Made him a household name.
Right. And The Prestige and Insomnia were not big hits either, but they didn't fail. And then he's made giant hits like this. Dark Knight Rises was a big hit. Interstellar and Inception were as well. Dunkirk, which we didn't love, but that made a ton of money.
And it was nominated for Best Picture. And
His first ever director nomination, too.
Oh my God, I can't believe that was his first ever Best Director nomination.
There's so much story in this film, and one thing that isn't really dwelled on for too long, but it's an early part of the film, are the inept vigilantes in hockey pads.
I wear hockey pads!
Batman somehow bends a gun with one hand in the scene that comes along as well. RoboCop-esque.
Yeah, come on.
You need something to hold the gun down, pinning it if you're even... Well, Batman's not that strong anyway. He can't be. He's still a man. It's fun, but it's also pretty dumb.
Why not just let these guys in hockey pads? They're not doing anything that you're not doing. They're just not rich.
He ties them up along with the Scarecrow. This is another movie that Cillian Murphy's been in that Nolan has made. He's been in a ton of the Nolan movies, much like Michael Caine's in almost all of them. And Cillian Murphy played the Scarecrow in all three of these movies. Small role here, small role in Dark Knight Rises, and of course he's the main villain in the first. Well, I guess Ra's al Ghul is, but that's another movie with a lot of villains. I guess they all have a lot of villains, don't they?
He always set out to make a trilogy, right? They assume that Batman Begins would do well, and he had a trilogy.
When Batman Begins came out, I don't know that they would have thought of the franchise thing. Well, maybe by 2005 they would have. But it wasn't quite as obvious as it's become. We talked on Iron Man last week. They only did that bit with Sam Jackson in the post-credit sequence. I've got an initiative I want to talk to you about, Tony, because they realized that Iron Man was going to be a success. They didn't know for sure they'd be able to make the blockbuster series of films they have. Same with this. The DCEU has not succeeded like the MCU has. But they probably thought realistically they could make a whole franchise out of all of it. This new version where they've got Ben Affleck playing Batman, obviously they thought that, and it may not really work out so well.
I haven't seen any of them just because I keep reading the reviews and being discouraged. Mm-hmm.
There have to be some criticisms of this film. One of them is, how did Batman and Rachel survive the fall from the penthouse window? Okay, his cape slows them down, but they still break the car when they land on it.
They didn't survive. The rest of the film is their death rattle fantasy. In her fantasy, she burns alive.
How's Harvey? Safe. Are you safe?
Dude. It's ridiculous. They dent the car. How are their bodies fine?
Just like Batman destroys Scarecrow's van. He lands on it, which also stops for some reason. Doesn't keep going. Just by landing on it from a couple of floors up. Now, one thing that apparently is real, and you questioned it during the film, and I did too. The skyhook thing, according to the internet, is legit. And apparently it's not even a painful extraction. There's no big jolt, although we both agreed, kind of like the Iron Man thing, how does his body not get torn in half or his brains get rattled with a severe concussion? Both of them in this case.
There must be some give in the rope. That's the only explanation, because it doesn't make sense. If the plane is going fast enough, it would just absolutely...
So maybe they're more exposed in reality in Afghanistan or wherever they are. By the way, I put this online, but one correction about Iron Man, that was Afghanistan. I looked online and it says, whatever, the Kandahar province or something, Afghanistan. So he was kidnapped by Afghans. So there are these people in Afghanistan.
They don't name the Taliban, they call them something else.
The Ten Rings.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So one thing I did like an awful lot, though, that has been brought up before, is that why don't people ever guess that he's both Batman and Bruce Wayne, or maybe figured out somehow? And of course, in some
of the
other movies...
Well, his accountant does.
Right, okay, I'm getting to that. But in so many other movies, he's outed and doesn't seem to matter. But anyway, I like the whole thing where Fox, Morgan Freeman, has this whole thing. He says, you think that your client is secretly a vigilante using his bare fist to beat people to a pulp, and you blackmail this man? And when he said that, it was kind of like the line in Breaking Bad where you think that they're not going to make drugs anymore, and they're going to stop because they barely got away from Tuco in season one into season two. And Walt says on the phone to Jesse, what's changed, Jesse? I remember hearing that and thinking, good point. Okay, yeah, he still needs to make the money, so why not? Same with this. The lawyer's got a great point, and Fox just tears it down. Okay, yeah, I can see why the guy doesn't... Although he does later on revive the thing and goes on the Gotham City News, I guess, GCN.
One of the many crises, I forgot to mention that crisis, the Joker says either somebody kills that little weasel in an hour or he's going to blow up the hospital.
And also Batman... And Batman
in one of the best scenes when he blows up the hospital.
Batman has to have his face revealed, but it doesn't actually happen. Harvey says he's Batman anyway. Yeah, the hospital thing. Great touches abound in that. When the Joker gives Harvey the gun and then Harvey's flipping the coin, if you look closely, the Joker's holding the hammer on the gun with his thumb. So even if the coin lands the wrong way, the gun's not going to go off.
Oh, I didn't notice that.
So the Joker, again, has a plan. But then we get that great moment where you don't know what happened, although realistically he's not going to get killed. But then again, they kill Rachel midway through this movie. Mid-sentence, like in Interstellar, one of the great moments in Interstellar is Matt Damon is in the middle of saying something. Bang, he's dead too. I didn't see that coming with killing off Rachel, especially Harvey, whatever she says, and boom, she's incinerated.
Oh, yeah, that moment is so well done. That's one of the things that I'm talking about when I say Christopher Nolan will just blow you away with visually or even to the timing of that to, as you say, cut her off mid-sentence. She doesn't even get to finish what she's saying and she's gone and that's it. You never expect her character to die. She's such a big character in all the Batman comics and movies. What do you think of the recasting? I tend to think that her character's so underwritten it doesn't really matter who plays her. I never had a problem with Katie Holmes. And I wasn't blown away by Maggie Gyllenhaal either.
She's got some bad lines in the first one, probably more than anyone else.
Oh yeah.
It's not Katie Holmes' fault.
It's a script crime what they make that poor woman say in that.
She can act. She's not the best actress I've ever seen, but she's not a bad actress. Maggie Gyllenhaal is better, but I don't think they had to recast it. But I was reading that it wasn't that they didn't want Holmes anymore, because that was what everyone was saying at the time. It was more that she was just busy with some other role. In fact, I think she did Mad Money.
Yeah, that's the movie she did instead. There was quite a bit of scandal going on with her at that time. I think that's when her marriage to Tom Cruise was breaking up.
he maybe power played her out of it. Maybe he said, you make that movie and we're through.
Any number of things could have been happening. Someday she'll write the book. If she outlives him, maybe she'll write a memoir and we can finally find out what happened with those two. But I don't really trust the official story of why she wasn't in the film. But a lot of people thought that Maggie Gyllenhaal being cast as Rachel was going to make a better film. She's just a plot device.
And she's so important to so many people, both Bruce and Harvey, but also to Alfred. He didn't raise her, but he knew her from when she was a kid. Mm-hmm. And she's an important political figure as an assistant DA.
And she seems lovable, and you certainly sympathize with her, but she's just there to remind us that somebody gives a shit about Bruce, or that Bruce has a motivation to want to drop the Batman and just live a normal life.
Mm-hmm. But anyway, the hospital thing. So after the confrontation between the Joker and now Two-Face, we get that great cut of the Joker sanitizing his hands, which everyone laughs at. I remember in the theater, everyone was laughing at that. And then, yeah, he can't get the thing to work. I was reading that was a mistake, and I was reading it wasn't a mistake. When the bomb doesn't go off and blow up the whole hospital, it blows up a lot of the hospital, and then he jumps onto the bus and gets away. Whether it's a mistake or not, again, what a great acting choice. That whole sort of, which is also in Ocean's 11, that whole thing with, oh, did you bring extra batteries? Maybe that's an homage to Ocean's 11, I don't know.
But the story is that the explosives actually didn't work when they were shooting the scene, and instead of looking out and yelling, cut, he went with it, he improv'd.
I'd rather that wasn't a mistake, did. Whatever. It's a great moment in any
okay.
case.
Okay, so, oh my god. And also, and who knows who's responsible for this, him dressed as a nurse with the dress. One of my favorite things about the Joker is I like to imagine him going to CVS and buying Manic Panic, you know, green, and then going home and dyeing his hair, setting a little timer, and then rinsing it out when the time comes, and then every day before he leaves the house with all his makeup.
Much like Donald Trump putting on his makeup.
Yeah, you know, putting on his makeup and just getting all dolled up. They imply that he makes his own clothes, even, because they say there's no labels on his clothes, they're all custom made. I guess it's possible somebody else makes
them. Although, hang on, I was rewatching the scene where he confronts the gangsters, and he says to Gamble, the big black guy who's got bad lines too, kill the clown, all that stuff. How about this suit? You should know. You bought it. I think he stole the guy's clothes. Although they wouldn't really fit him, would they? Because Gamble's a lot bigger than the Joker. But that's what's implied.
Or is it because he just took his money? So he bought it with his money.
Oh, that could be what he's saying, too.
Or he went to the fabric store. He went to Fabricland. He picked out his colors.
Fabricland.
He compared them to one another. I don't know if they have Fabricland in the States or other parts of the world.
But
in Canada, it's the most annoying jingle on the radio, and it has been for like 2 decades. So he goes to Fabricland. He compares his colors and his patterns.
It's gotta be purple.
He lays it out on the table, and he measures out his patterns, and he cuts it very carefully and sews it all together.
He's a tailor. He's got other things he can be doing.
He's got a Judy in his apartment.
I do like this angle, though, that he puts on his own makeup and he dyes his own hair, because, of course, the famous story from the comics is that this happened to him by falling in toxic waste. A human being probably wouldn't live if they fell in toxic waste, just simply from drinking it in, let alone it getting on your skin, your hair, and everything else.
And it would just burn you. It wouldn't leave you colorful. Mm. Probably the creepiest he ever looks in this movie is the one scene where he's not wearing makeup.
It's a when very brief second.
Yeah, you don't see him for very long, which is probably good because you don't want to linger on the makeup that is creating the scars. But just at a glance, it's so much creepier somehow when he doesn't have the makeup and he's not in full character and he's dressed like a cop.
And nearly kills the mayor, but then somehow Gordon guesses and stops him, dives in front.
There's so many things, you know, on the Wikipedia page doing research, and it's a couple of days after watching the movie, oh yeah, he tries to kill the mayor. So many things happen in the movie. Just way too much.
Well, Batman puts more people in danger than he even normally does with the Batpod. Well, it's cool, he ends up on the Batpod, and that becomes his mode of transit for about half the film. And of course, he could have killed the Joker, and maybe should have. Wipes out and all that. The Joker, when he does almost die by falling off of the building and laughing the whole way, is the way the Joker in the 1989 Batman dies. He falls from a high height. It's a Disney kind of thing, because a lot of their villains fall from high heights, so then the good guy doesn't have to be a bad guy by killing somebody. But Rachel almost dies, or probably should have. She falls out the penthouse and Batman saves her, but they both should have been broken at least from that. The Joker would have died, but Batman saves him by shooting his bat hook and rappelling back up there. And then that is how Harvey dies.
Oh, yeah.
The Joker's a strange boss, too. He's employing a lot of the schizophrenics who escaped Arkham from the first movie. I do like how that ties back in, though, too.
I want to know how anybody works for him after the bank heist at the beginning, because he kills every one of his workers.
His hired goons,
yeah. It would have been so much more believable if he were a good boss to some extent, if his goons were loyal to him, maybe even devoted to his philosophy of seeking chaos just like him. It's occasionally implied that they are, or that they're suffering from mental illness, like the guy with the bomb in his guts. But after that heist, no criminal should be willing to work for him. It doesn't make any sense that he has all these loyal and competent people.
Because they're insane. They don't have a normal working brain.
Yeah, but they know how to wire two fairies for massive explosions without being detected. They're too competent to be crazy enough to work for the Joker.
He does take the men from the Russian guy, or the Chechen, whatever the hell they call him, so he does take people who aren't escaped inmates as well.
Again, and I only have a rudimentary understanding of the mob that comes from mostly Martin Scorsese movies, but the way I see it, if you're a Chechen mafia guy, and your boss that you're loyal to, who's part of this Chechen mob that you've devoted your life to, gets murdered by an insane clown, you don't then shrug your shoulders and say, "You're my boss now!" I don't know if that's how it works.
What else is the guy going to do? Or the guys, what are they going to do?
I guess it's not something I ever think too hard about when I'm watching these movies.
Well, when the Joker kills Gamble in this, that whole sort of, we're holding tryouts. He's taken those guys too from Gamble, but they also just killed the guy, so they're available. Well, strap on your irony pants, because the Joker survives the movie, but Heath Ledger did not, as we know. And Two-Face dies in the movie, but Aaron Eckhart did not. So we probably would have had the Joker in the next movie had Ledger not died. And Eckhart, I think, at one point thought he was going to be in The Dark Knight Rises, and his picture's in it, and his character's a big part of it in a way. That's what ends up getting Gordon outed, because he wrote a letter about how Harvey was going to kill my family, rather than being the hero that he's portrayed as at the end of the film. But I always thought that was just obviously unintentional. No one wanted that to happen, but one bad guy lives in reality, but not in the movie, and vice versa. So Christian Bale, of course, is the main character. We've barely even talked about the guy, and he always gets overlooked in these movies. I think he did a pretty good job in this trilogy. He won an Oscar for The Fighter a few years after this. I think he's got great range in general. He's not allowed to show that much in this movie. And as I've said many times in our podcast, he's a character who's acting. He's always got to act as the billionaire playboy. He's a billionaire, but he's sure not a playboy. And he plays Bruce Wayne the way he played Patrick Bateman in some ways, because that was the original American Psycho, the movie that was only a few years before Batman Begins.
That's so true that he's just like a rich asshole. Mm. But he's not really. Well, he is kind of an asshole. But not in the way everybody thinks he's an asshole.
And we all mock the voice. It's a go-to laugh with our friends when I do the Batman impression. But being that gravelly makes a lot of sense. Adam West never did anything different when he played Batman. He was Bruce Wayne and Batman the exact same way, with a mask on and a cape and all that stuff. But this version, it makes sense. He's going to sound different. So is it too much, especially in Dark Knight Rises? Maybe. But I was also reading that in the first film, there's some kind of deleted scene, or maybe it's in the movie, I forget now. I haven't seen Batman Begins in a long time. Where he's got a device in there. So he has sonar-type things in his ears so he can hear stuff. We do see a scene like that in the first movie. But he also has a thing that makes his voice sound different. And then people also question, why is he talking that when no one's around? The Catwoman in the third movie leaves him, and so that's what that feels like. Well, maybe he's trying to sound normal, but he can't.
It's a device, yeah. Speaking of devices, what do you make of the little touch at the end where Lucius fights with him about the cell phone device that allows him to spy on the entire city of Gotham?
Another story point in this, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Which Facebook and Google have now since done.
Our cell phones are all listening to us.
And they probably were then, which didn't know it then.
Yeah, they're just mining us for a different kind of data, as far as we know. I don't know if there's even that much that we could say or do about it, if it's even illegal. Of course, this movie implies that he only used it for good to stop the Joker, and then
type in your name, which Lucius does.
Yes, yeah. And then they shut the hall down, so you don't have to feel that conflicted about it, guys. Don't even worry.
I have to find him, Lucius. And he does have to find him.
And he wouldn't have stopped the Joker if he hadn't have used the cell phone technology.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's a complicated issue, and that's why it's good Lucius has issues with it. This is really wrong.
I mean, much like Iron Man, this movie has some pretty questionable politics in it. It has ultimately a very conservative point of view, because it implies that the only way to stop crime is with violence, basically, and that crime enforcement or vigilantes is the way to stop criminals, not helping the community in any way, which is what studies actually show is the way to make places safer. And it's also the implication that one rich guy being super powerful and making decisions for all of Gotham is the way it ought to be. All things are right as long as you have your rich superhero whose superpower is being born rich.
But he wants that not to be the case anymore. He doesn't want to be Batman because he wants Harvey to be the legal Batman.
And Harvey kind of has a similar attitude where he wants to have a lot of power. He wants to appoint a protector of Gotham. He wants to kind of supersede the courts. So again, this very conservative attitude. But that's true for most superhero films. If you were to see them as insidious, if you were to be paranoid, you could see them as a conservative propaganda.
But Bruce is trying to give up the job. He should just say, I'm Batman no more, like Spider-Man does in Spider-Man 2.
But he's not giving up the job. He's passing the baton on to somebody else who's going to do the exact same thing.
But through legal
means. The exact
means.
Same spirit. But I'm saying that Harvey has a point where he's like, I would just like to appoint a protector, go above the law.
A dark knight?
Yeah. Harvey doesn't really respect the law, the courts, and democracy either.
like I said, he wants to be a criminal in a lot of ways, and it's not that hard a push for him. All he needs is a little push, like sanity. So I do believe his twist, again, for that reason alone. Matt Damon, by the way, was, I think, the first choice for Harvey Dent. And I love Matt Damon, but really? Aaron Eckhart maybe wasn't an obvious choice either, but Matt Damon, I don't know.
I bet he could pull it off.
Well, one thing about this role, whether you like Eckhart's performance or not, Tommy Lee Jones, as great an actor as he is terrible. The worst thing he's ever done is in Batman Forever.
Then he was just miscast. I don't really remember Batman Forever all that well.
Well, the old veterans, Michael Caine, Morgan Freeman, Gary Oldman. Caine's been in every Nolan movie since Batman Begins. Every single one. He's won 2 Oscars, has made thousands of movies, and he's really good as Alfred in these movies. I really like the running thing in this first one. You haven't given up on me, Alfred. Never. I think he says that at least twice. Although he does give up on him in the third movie, at least for a little while, because he leaves.
I always have a problem with all these films where Alfred is basically Bruce's adopted father, his most trusted confidant and certainly closest friend or closest thing to a family member he has. And yet he still makes him do butler stuff. Literally, there's a scene where he's having a fundraiser and Alfred is handing out champagne to the guests like he's some out-of-work actor. Also, he's like 90 years old. Why are you still making him work,
That's
Bruce?
More blatant in the original Batman, well, the 1989 Batman, that he's an ancient man. I don't think Michael Caine seems like he's that old. But yes, he is doing butler stuff, and it's more evident. They even talk about in the 1989 one, I couldn't find my socks without him. He has one person working in that giant mansion.
I do agree with you, though, that I think Michael Caine is the best Alfred. We can argue on and on, but I guess who the best Batman is, but Michael Caine is best Alfred, and Heath Ledger is the best Joker.
Jeremy Irons is the new Alfred. He's all right, but Caine's better. Morgan Freeman is Batman's Q, and this living legend might be ruined by scandal. So I haven't heard anything about his scandal in a little while now, so maybe it's not an issue, I don't know. But what a shame if that's the case, that he's another one.
I don't know if he's getting lost in the shuffle, if people are just letting it go because his crimes were kind of minor in the scheme of things, or what? I don't know.
Well, this isn't his best work, but he was quite good as Lucius Fox.
There's a nice symmetry. Heath Ledger said that when he was doing research for the part, one of his influences was Sid Vicious. Mm-hmm. I like that. Sid Vicious was very famously and incredibly portrayed by Gary Oldman back in the 80s.
Gary Oldman, I've always said this, played Sid Vicious, Lee Harvey Oswald, Dracula, Beethoven, in the span of, well, Vicious was before a lot of those, but those other three were in the span of just a couple of years. And now he's played Commissioner Gordon, and he won an Oscar for playing Churchill.
He's one of the most chameleon actors of his generation. He can really disappear into a role, and I remember being, I don't know, 15, 16, and discovering that the same actor played all these parts, and absolutely blew my mind, because he disappears so completely. Commissioner Gordon, he's wasted on that character. It's kind of strange that he plays it, because it's a little below him to play something so banal.
There's a great moment that Kevin Smith has talking about how in Dark Knight Rises, when Batman reveals to Commissioner Gordon at the very end of the film, before he goes out and maybe kills himself, or maybe doesn't kill himself with that bomb, he says something like, anyone can be a hero, even someone putting a jacket around a young boy's shoulders to let him know the world hadn't ended. And Kevin Smith starts to tear up and cry. You can't see it. It's a YouTube clip. It's just anyway. It was a podcast, I think is what it was, but it's on YouTube is where I found it. And his whole point is, you are my hero. You're the top cop, but for all these decades, you've been the guy I've looked up to. And of course, the guy I looked up to didn't even know who I was until right now. And it's not a moment that really got to me, but when I saw Dark Knight Rises after I'd heard that clip, it made me feel emotional too. So it is a nice payoff for Oldman in those three films. Maybe he's wasted, but at least he gets that good payoff. And I guess maybe Tarantino-esque, Nolan likes his 80s, maybe not legends, but actors who were hot back then, who aren't really so much now. Eric Roberts and Anthony Michael Hall have relatively important supporting roles in this. Roberts is one of the mobsters. He made his name in Runaway Train. He's Julia's brother, but hasn't done a lot of things since then. But he's pretty solid in this. And then Anthony Michael Hall is the Gotham City News anchor. He was such a nerd in the Brat Pack era, but then got a buff and all cool as he grew up, including in this. He doesn't look like the same guy at all. We talked about Nolan and the producers and writers, so let's skip down to the text. The movie's got a varying aspect ratio because of the IMAX footage. It's a little more jarring than I used to think it was. I really noticed when it would go between the 2:25:1 ratio, which is mostly what this is, but then into the IMAX, which fills your widescreen TV. But the Blu-ray looked pretty good, I thought. It is pretty new. It should look good. His cinematographer, who was his regular guy back then, Wally Pfister, who won an Oscar for Inception, and now he's a director. The editing was by Lee Smith, by himself, which is weird for a movie this long and this big. He's been with Nolan since Batman Begins, and he won an Oscar earlier this year for Dunkirk. And the composers, Hans Zimmer and James Newton Howard. I don't know if they actually worked together, if they did separate sections. I think they probably did separate sections, like editors usually do. It's not like Lee Smith and some other guy would have been editing in the same room. They have different jobs to do. Zimmer, we've covered a lot in the last couple years, in Thumb and Louise, The Lion King. So what do you think of the cinematography, the editing, and the music?
Well, like I said earlier, I find his action scenes are poorly edited. I don't know if you can lay that at the feet of the editor or at Christopher Nolan.
Probably more so him. I also read that Nolan does his own second unit. Maybe that's the problem, that some of these second unit guys, Spielberg used the same guys forever. Vic Armstrong or something like that. Spielberg did in all of his great action films. Maybe Spielberg would have been good if he did it himself, but this guy was better. Yeah. So you use him for expeditious reasons, but also maybe he's just better than you. So Nolan maybe would be better if he would concentrate on the smaller scenes and let someone else handle the bigger ones.
Yeah, because the technical aspect of making a car chase look like a believable car chase and not like a confusing mess where cars like change their position on the highway, or literally there's a moment in Dark Knight Rises where... Yeah. You know what I'm about to say? Where he goes into a tunnel during the day and he comes out and it's nighttime. Right. Stuff like that.
It's where a you're long like, tunnel.
What is happening? Yeah. I don't like that kind of stuff. I'm probably finicky about it because I'm an editor, so I kind of have to find fault with that. Also, the crisis fatigue. This probably should have happened on the script level, but there's just one too many stories going on.
They packed so much.
It really should have been cleaned up, and that's something that I think you could have done in post-production. So I'm going to fault that. The cinematography, I agree with you. Changing of aspect ratios really annoys me. Just because you're shooting on 70mm doesn't mean that you can't force a different aspect ratio.
Well, because the IMAX has to be that 1:85:1 ratio, why don't they just make the whole movie that way?
Yes, exactly.
Now, maybe the idea is that when you watch it, hey, believe me, when I went to see this movie finally after a month when I couldn't, and that very first shot is that great big outside shot and the gunshot or whatever it is, the repelling arrow, whatever you call the thing, blasts out, and then we see the criminals set up for the bank job. It's overwhelming. I don't think I knew that was going to happen, because if you haven't seen IMAX before, and people probably have at some point, I haven't seen it in a few years, neither have you, but when you see a movie in IMAX that actually fills the IMAX screen, you can't see anything else.
Yeah.
So maybe that's the idea, is that I'm going to blow you away when I do these kinds of shots, but then sometimes it's only for a matter of seconds. I don't really remember noticing it when I saw it in 2008, but I really notice it now, surprisingly, when it's a smaller screen.
Just like
you said,
when you're shooting this stuff on 35, just shoot it in the same aspect ratio. Other filmmakers do it. So, yeah, I really find that like a dumb choice. And he's also one of those guys who's devoted to still shooting on film while the rest of the world has moved on to digital and nobody can see the difference but him and his magic eyes. Fine.
And Tarantino as well.
No, there's something about that that just makes me roll my eyes. But visually, it is such a beautiful film. He's such a visionary at creating an image, an unforgettable image. It's really where his largest gift lies in every single film. There is just one breathtaking, unforgettable moment after another. As for Hans Zimmer's score, it's not that much overkill.
That's true.
The actions, some of the action scenes are really, that car chase we keep talking about, there's no music in it at all.
It's just sound
effects. Or if it's really, really quiet, you really don't notice it. There's no score, and I swear that makes it so much more impactful.
I think you mostly hear that music. I'm doing it wrong, but you get the idea.
Yeah, Zimmer's
as
the drone master,
as a scene
right?
setter. So it sets something up, but you don't really hear it beyond that.
Yeah, so I appreciate that.
All right. Obviously, there's a lot of influence from The Dark Knight. Fanboys have been whacking off to this movie for 10 years, and they'll continue whacking. I'm a big fan of it, too, but fanboys would disagree with everything you said that's been remotely critical. And they shouldn't, because no movie's perfect. Batman is, of course, one of the eternal American characters. So many movies, so many comics. We talked about that a little on Iron Man last week. The bank job at the beginning has got a real big Heat influence, and Nolan seems to be big into Michael Mann in general, but there's the music that's similar to Heat in a way. The heist itself, the criminals are dressed alike, and then William Fichtner, who is the bank manager, is also in Heat.
I was like, what's this guy doing in such a small part? I love that guy.
You're dead! Although, as we pointed out, when Joker puts that bomb in his mouth, which is just a dud, why doesn't he just take it out when Joker turns around?
Just open your mouth and it'll fall right out. Another great touch, though. The bomb is a dud. Just another one of the surprising things.
In that scene, he also reveals his face, because he's wearing a mask like the rest of them are, and he says something like, whatever doesn't kill you makes you stranger. And that's a good line. Also, the visual of laughter is the best medicine. The truck, when they're trying to get to... Dent, and it says slaughter is the best medicine. That's a nice touch, too. Back to influence. The upside-down shot in Joker's last scene is reminiscent of De Niro in Cape Fear. At one point, Scorsese just turns the camera over. I don't really know why. In this case, I guess, well, maybe both cases, it's about the world's upside down. That's really more true in The Dark Knight than it was in Cape Fear.
Movies about chaos, too, both of them, about just tearing someone apart by creating random acts of violence.
And seeing in both cases their hair standing straight up, or what looks like straight up, because, of course, it's hanging down. Is also a weird touch. I guess that's the idea. It's unsettling.
God, it's so great. I love that shot. That was just one of those moments in the theater when that happens. I just wanted to cheer.
And his character's left unresolved. When we last see him, he's still hanging there. Now, presumably he doesn't stay there, but when the movie's over, that's where he was. And of course, unfortunately, he wasn't going to appear in another movie because the guy, was dead. The biggest influence of all, though, maybe more so than anything else I've just mentioned, is that the Oscars went from 5 Best Picture nominees to as many as 10 after this was snubbed. Maybe Wall-E was part of that too, because that may have been a Best Picture nominee, and maybe both of them should have been. Dark Knight definitely should have been. Curious Case of Benjamin Button, The Reader, out! Get him out of there!
How can you believe that?
That wasn't the greatest year for nominees to begin with, but there was such a controversy this movie got, and I'll read them off in a second. 8 nominations, but not one for Best Picture.
The Oscars has just got to get off their high horse and stop insisting that only a certain kind of movie can win Best Picture of the Year. Anybody who listens to us regularly knows that I wanted Get Out to win Best Picture so bad last year, even though I absolutely knew that it wouldn't. I still believe it was the best movie of 2017.
Maybe the success of the comic book movies and the lack of Oscar nominations for this one and some of the Avengers-type films has made people backlash against that, and a Get Out doesn't even get nominated 5 to 10 years ago.
Absolutely.
But not only did it get nominated, but it won the original screenplay award for Jordan Peele,
who had one of the best moments of the show where the camera caught him going backstage and having his pinch me moment. There's this really beautiful shot of his reaction once he thinks that nobody can see him anymore. And oh my God, one of my favorite things I've ever seen in the Oscars, I think.
So maybe The Dark Knight being snubbed eventually led to things like that. The underdog type films, not that Dark Knight's an underdog, but at award shows, it was and still is in a lot of ways.
And Heath Ledger's win was the first posthumous acting award since Peter Finch?
In Network,
so since the 70s.
And he's the first, I think still only, to be nominated for a movie of this type, a comic book film. Not nominated, but win, sorry.
To win. Oh yeah, it was like a huge win for it to be nominated for anything other than a technical.
And everyone knew he was going to win. It wasn't like it was any kind of debate. Robert Downey Jr. in Tropic Thunder was a great nominee. In another year, he might have won. But there was no doubt that Ledger was going to win that night. He won every award in existence, pretty much, going into the show.
Nobody in their right mind would want to have beat him for that Oscar.
Everyone's crying. It's a really emotional moment. So the Oscars then. So one for supporting actor, of course, and the sound effects. It was nominated for 6 more. The editing, okay. The cinematography, the visual effects, the sets, the sound, and the makeup. I don't know how many of those, but quite a few went to Slumdog Millionaire, which was the Best Picture winner that year. And we covered that earlier this year.
Talk about a retrospect. Poor choice.
Well, between all the movies we've covered so far from 2008, it's at least 2 of them, isn't it? Slumdog and this. And we mentioned Wall-E, Iron Man last week. What would you say was the best of all of those?
I think I would say Dark Knight.
Okay.
I really love Wall-E, and I was really happy Slumdog won when it did. I really enjoyed it at the time, but it hasn't aged nearly as well as Dark Knight
and
has.
And of those fellow nominees, it was the best movie, but it wasn't the best movie of the year.
And how can you deny both its popularity, its influence, and just the sheer quality of it? It really The Dark Knight, yeah. Did something that I don't think any other film has really accomplished before, and I know part of that is just lightning in a bottle of having the right time and place, the right script, the right cast and everything, but there's something so special about this movie.
The Dark Knight set a peak that the DCEU hasn't come close to matching since.
That's for sure.
In fact, in the eyes of a lot of people, it's gone downhill. I think some of the ones they've done have been okay, but I haven't seen Justice League yet, and maybe by the time this gets posted, I will have. It will be on demand soon, but I haven't seen it yet.
And Wonder Woman was good. I liked Wonder Woman.
Right, that was good. I don't think there's a better superhero movie maybe ever, and these two villains are probably the best comic book movie villains we've ever seen. You may not like Harvey as much as I do, but I think he's very close to being as good.
I mean, I like him better than Scarecrow. I think villains is one of those things that actually most comic movies let me down with, considering
MCU does over and over again.
Yeah, definitely. Considering how much free reign they have to do anything they want, Marvel's kind of notorious for having these boring, just plain evil...
Until Thanos.
Okay, yeah.
And Loki was good.
Yeah, Loki's an exception in that respect, too. And while I would agree with you, yeah, it's the best superhero film ever made, if it's just me on a night home alone and I want to watch a superhero movie, this probably isn't even the second or third film that I would go to.
It isn't?
No. Well, I like it. I really enjoyed watching it again, but it's just such a downer, and I tend... like, a superhero movie, my favorite, probably still after all these years, is Spider-Man 2. I love Sam Raimi's Spider-Man.
What's more fun than this and maybe any of the DC movies?
I won't say it's a better film than Dark Knight.
But more fun.
But again, part of that plays on just the fact that I don't love Batman as a hero.
Yeah, okay. Also, let's not forget, kudos to Bale and Kane for making this believable. And people have mocked the scene Kane has in the third movie, early on when he leaves him. But I think their relationship is great. It's maybe the heart of the film. Bale is always overlooked in these movies because he's up against Ledger and Eckhart in this. And then Tom Hardy as Bane in the last one. And maybe a little less so with Neeson and Murphy in the first movie. But I think he holds down the role very well. If he's not the best Batman, he's got the best relationship with Alfred. And of course, Alfred's the best one, so that makes that better too. And faults aside, this is one of my favorite films since the turn of the century. I talked about it on Eternal Sunshine we did years ago, how I had some kind of top 10 list of the first 10 years of the century so far. And that was my number one. Lord of the Rings, I combined them all as number 2. And I think Dark Knight was 8 or 9 or something. What does that even mean? But the point that I wanted it to be in there says a lot. And it was only a few years old at that point when I did that list.
It's number 4 on the IMDb Top 250. It really belongs there.
If the AFI does another Top 100, and I don't think they ever will, because they haven't for a long time now. this would probably make it.
It really ought to. Just for its popularity alone.
And influence and success.
Oh, yeah.
So next week we cover a David Cronenberg flick for the first time. Big left turn here. His adaptation of one of Stephen King's approximately 7,000 books, The Dead Zone.
He's a real superhero. He has actual superpowers.
Yeah, so it isn't really Superhero Month, but he has real superpowers. And our last movie of July's... No, that's not really the case at all. Anyway, so the coming attractions trivia is also about death, like this one was, about the Joker dying in the various live-action Batman movies. Christopher Walken has won an Oscar. He's played a Bond villain. He's played a Batman villain. He's worked with a wide range of directors, Woody Allen, Quentin Tarantino, and Steven Spielberg, to name three. And he was in a Stephen King adaptation, obviously The Dead Zone. How many times did he die in those seven movies?
So for the answer to that question, please check out our next podcast about The Dead Zone. But what if you can't wait until then? Well, you can check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on Apple Podcasts. We've covered well over 250 movies now, including all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and or 2007 lists of the best American movies ever made. Every episode is available for free, but perhaps in exchange, while you're there, you could give us a rating and a review. That really means a lot to us.
Give us a good review!
If you'd like to reach Ryan and me, we're both on Twitter. I am at Bev Ellis Ellis, and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com.
Contact us!
And once more, we would like to thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee. Don't forget that you can enjoy a one-time 10% discount on any coffee purchase if you use the code TOP100PROJECT at checkout. That's all one word, TOP100PROJECT, and it is not case-sensitive.
The podcast... Ta-da! It's gone!
And cut.